Hey there, friends. Mix Punk Rogers here. Diving deep into the heart of transformation with our second episode of Freaks and Ferals, the Firekeepers podcast. Today, I have a two-parter for you that's rich in dialogue and discovery. In the first part, we're destigmatizing addiction and self-harm and delving into the complex world of recovery and healing spaces. In the second part, we'll be exploring the vibrant landscapes of embodied, trauma-informed, play, creativity, and self-care. Joining us in this essential exploration is the incredible Erowyn Ambrose, a beacon of resilience and healing. Certified in the Resilience Toolkit, Erowyn brings her expertise as a storyteller, creative spirit, and warrior in the realms of recovery and self-discovery. With her background as a teaching artist, race equity and healing justice facilitator, and storytelling circle facilitator, she's uniquely equipped to guide us through cultivating a compassionate inner dialogue, creating embodied, trauma-informed, resilience-oriented healing spaces, and designing a self-care regimen that honors our most authentic selves. Together, we're stepping out of the rigidity, isolation, and disembodiment of the Western mindset, and into a space where we can connect and reconnect, embrace our quirks, and build within us a sanctuary guided by our inner compass. Let's light up the path of self-reclamation, free ourselves from confining beliefs, and turn our trials into treasures. Welcome, Erowyn. Oh, I'm so glad to see you. The thing that we were most excited about talking about today was dismantling stigma around addiction and self-harm. That's pretty important to both of us. So, you know, you've had extensive work that you've done in healing and recovery. And so how do you perceive the stigma surrounding addiction and self-harm?
Well, first of all, thank you for asking me to speak. This is, as you know, one of my favorite topics. And I have so much to say about it. So let me see if I can start. You know, it reminds me the way that, I think of how also like generally how Hollywood depicts addiction is also the way that perpetuates that stigma, right? And so I think our jumping off place for this topic was I was watching that show. It was called Painkillers. And in it, they have, you know, one of the characters takes oxycodone as it's, you know, first prescribed at that time. And it's so funny because it was when it was people didn't know how addictive it was and it was being touted as non-addictive. And the wife of him, he's like runs an auto center or something. They have kids. You know, he's a professional, blue collar professional in the community. And then there was a question like, is this addictive? And then the wife goes, oh, he's not an addict. He's not an addict. It won't be a problem. And that hit me really hard as how people view, and it was said with some disdain, like he's not an addict. Mm-hmm. Like, ew, mm-hmm. like he's not that, the other. And then eventually, of course, he does get terribly addicted and does pass away, transition from it. But when he does go to the meetings to get help too, the people depicted in the meetings also look like people that, oh, them, poor them, you know, the down and outs. And they look scruffy and they look like they've just really had a hard life. And yes, that is true, yet that's, you know, by no means represents the spectrum of people struggling with substances or behavior or whatever it is. And I think what I have come to understand 20 years in recovery on a very varied journey is that It's funny because I think there are some recovery programs that also perpetuate that otherness, right? We've talked about this, like that otherness, like I'm an addict or I'm an alcoholic and I'm separate from that. And they're the normal people. And then there's me and I'm different. And that was something that helped me for some time. But then as I started to grow in my awareness of the body and how we try to soothe pain, emotional pain, mental pain, that we, you know, it's like, it's not us and them, it's all of us. There's nothing different from me than from somebody who doesn't struggle with alcoholism. They just might have a different way that it's this need to soothe shows up. And it could be, for me, it's a gradient of harm at this point, a gradient of harm of whatever the thing is that people are soothing with or distracting with or dissociating with. This leads me to this idea of identity. Like, when is identity, naming an identity, really helpful to say, yes, I am this thing and I can not feel so alone. But then when does it limit our growth and healing? And I think that's where I've gotten to in my 20-year journey is I'm at a place now where I don't think there's an other. I don't describe myself as an alcoholic anymore. And I have a great metaphor that I came up with for, I was asked to do a talk for some law enforcement officers and some community workers in a small rural town in Wisconsin who were really struggling with their empathy to and compassion for people struggling with substance misuse, mostly oxycodone there. And is now a good time to share that, you think, what that metaphor is?
Sure. Yeah.
So I was thinking about it there because in it, so I was trying to think of a way to help people feel more compassion. And what I came to is that when people have complex PTSD, and that is basically when you have trauma that is unrelenting and doesn't give up and generally more relational somewhat as children are growing up, this creates a very complex discomfort in the body, like an extreme dysregulation of stress states, right? And sort of an inability to kind of get out of these extreme stress states. And so when people are in that, NARM, neuroaffective relational model, says a dysregulated nervous system will seek regulation at any cost, even if the cost is its life. So there is like a biological imperative for in service of survival to regulate that nervous system, right? To bring it down. And as you and I know from the work we do, like a dysregulated nervous system not only causes discomfort, but also health issues. Not only addiction or alcoholism, you know, these things, these behaviors, but it also causes autoimmune disorders, cancers, diabetes, right? Suicidality, like all these kind of things. So when I was thinking about it, I was like, oh, I'm like, complex PTSD is kind of like induced labor, right? So it's like, and I had an induced labor. So I know that what I know that was different for me in this induced labor, and it might be different for someone else, was that when the contractions started, they were unrelenting. There was no peak and trough. There was no like, here's the contraction, now you get a break. Here's the contraction, now you get a break. It was just on with no break. And it is almost impossible, right?
That's intense.
You don't have any break, no respite. And I said at that point, and I wanted the natural childbirth, right? I was all like, no epidural, I don't care what I say. But with unrelenting contractions, when I finally had someone say, you know, you can get relief, I was like, yes, please, please. And I got an epidural. And thank God I did, because it didn't take away the pain necessarily. It just made me numb from it. And that was a gift. My body was still shaking. I was vomiting and I was dilating, but like, I was like, I'm okay. Right. So like the epidural, I think these substances that people use or behavior are like an epidural. It's like that stuff is still going on, but you're numb from it. But once that wears off, the substance or the epidural, epidural, it's like, you know, you have the baby and then they're done. But with substances, right, it wears off and you're right back where you were. So really giving compassion that people are generally in a lot of like physical pain, which really exacerbates pain. Like the mental, emotional, physical pain is all the same. And emotional pain shows up.
Can you talk a little bit more? Can you talk a little bit more about that? About
yeah.
That connection?
So when I discovered, and this is from Sarah Warren's work with The Pain Relief Secret is her book, but I found her because I had chronic lower back pain, and her approach, it's clinical somatics. It's based on Thomas Hanna somatics. And so this is where I learned this idea. And it's about that we have muscle stress set points, and they're like these gamma loops in our muscle fibers. So what happens though, is if our stress starts to build like a frog in water, boiling water, right? We don't really realize, but we start to hold our body in certain ways. You see this with like posture and a lot of like functional muscular pain issues, right? All of us, lower pain, all the things. When your muscles are contracted like that, you actually experience pain more. Like you are more heightened. Pain is more prevalent. You are physically feeling more pain. And if something does hurt you painfully, it is more like they've looked at the neurology and there it's like bigger pain receptors, right? So it's like pain is constant. That's that contraction that never lets up. So people who are suffering from that, like they will turn to so many different things. So many different things. And I do remember though, at the beginning of my journey with this way of thinking about it, is that I was in a meeting for an organization, and they were talking about, I forget what we were talking about, but I mentioned something about addiction recovery, right? And the person leading it said, well, we're all addicted to something. That's where I got that gradient of harm, right? That gradient of harm. Yeah.
I think of it in terms of speed. Like there's kind of fast ways to unalive ourselves and much, much slower ways. That's kind of how I think about it.
Right. And like, yeah. So absolutely I see that. And I do love, like, it's hard for me to go to recovery meetings now, honestly, because of the othering, the so much of the othering. And I think it reinforces the stigma personally. I think it has a tendency to reinforce the stigma. And at the same time, both, and I'll say it's a lifesaver for some to claim that identity and to feel other with it, because it's so confusing and demoralizing and shameful to feel like I can't make a good decision around this. Why can you? Right. So like, what is wrong with me? And then being able to be in a collective or we're all fucked up. Right? Like, we're all a mess. And you're like, yay, my messy people. And here's a solution. That's profound. But it does, from a larger standpoint, put a stigma on people. Right. It puts a stigma. It's like with neurodivergence too. Right. We see that a lot in the neurodivergence community or any of these other communities.
Yeah. Well, two things come up. One is that there's that idea of like, we're all addicted. I think it kind of ends up minimizing is what you're saying. The like acute kind of fast ways that some people are propelling themselves towards, their own demise, really, because that's what addiction is, right? We're doing something repetitively, even though it's harming us. So there's that idea that it could be really helpful and unifying that, yes, actually addiction is far more prevalent. It's just, what are the things we're addicted to? Some things, as you've been saying, are like, there's a lot of stigma, there's a lot of association with there's a lot of negative association, and then there's like, how many people are addicted to overeating, right? Or how many people are addicted to sugar? me, how much, yeah. And then there's addiction to social media. But I really think like we can get addicted to absolutely anything. And it's really not about the thing itself. It's about our relationship to the thing, right? And what's happening. And so that's
and that was about. Really, so I was in for a good like 10 years, a very rigid approach to recovery, a very fundamentalist approach that was like very based in the, you know, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in it, it was even so specific, like if I am addicted to alcohol, I can only talk about that and be in spaces with other alcoholics. I can't even, if somebody's addicted to cocaine, they need to be in with cocaine people. But it was like the theory behind that, which was interesting from that group's perspective, was if I don't know specifically what I suffer from, how can I get the right medicine? Right. So if I say I'm an alcoholic and I'm actually a drug addict, I'm not going to get the right medicine in Alcoholics Anonymous. I need to hear my medicine in Narcotics Anonymous, because there is a different approach in some of these books and the literature. Right. And I could see that. And then at the same time, it was really interesting to see the othering happen even more in this other group. And I started teaching when I encountered the Resilience Toolkit in 2017-18 and really saw this like trauma-informed, embodied approach to nervous system awareness. And I like to say self-responsiveness rather than regulation, that is deeply rooted in social justice. It was really clear to me that that was missing from my recovery. And the universality of all of us, I started to really see working with, you know, thousands of folks over the last 7 years, like how we're all suffering from that, this, you know, discomfort. And I had someone show up. I created the Toolkit for Recovery, which was a group to come. And recovery for us was like anything. And I had learned this actually from a man doing sort of advanced step work, but you would go to it and he's like, for people who've been sober for a long time, you start to get like, yeah, I'm not really worried about using alcohol anymore. But he said, is there something you want to stop, but you can't, or something you want to start, but you can't? Mm-hmm. And let's go there. And I was like, oh, interesting. Right. Mm-hmm. So everyone, even in sobriety or recovery, I have found so many people show up to my workshops being like, I don't know why I'm here. And then as we would delve more into what recovery was, and I really would propose that question, is there something you want to stop doing, but it's causing you harm, but you can't? Oh, I'm reading romance novels. And you're like, ha ha ha. But they're like, yeah, but I'm not feeding my children when I do it. I'm reading hours and I'm checking out. And that started to really open my mind to this idea, right? That people are really suffering and people aren't able to kind of get the help they might need because they're not an addict or an alcoholic.
Yeah. And it just adds to, I love that self-responsiveness. It adds to like our own gaslighting of ourselves. So if we're suffering with this, but it's not like officially this under the category of bad things, then I must not really have a problem, or it must not be that bad, or that my suffering isn't really real around it.
Yeah. Yeah. And where do those folks go?
Yeah. There's a lot of like stratifying hierarchical of whose pain is more, or.
And you hear that, and not to bash recovery programs because they've saved lives and are a beautiful community, like, but there can be in some spaces, not all, but this kind of suffering Olympics and the trauma porn, right? Mine's worse than yours. And oh, I used to shoot up heroin in the bathroom and use the water from the toilet. Oh, well, you're not an addict if you haven't done blah, 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 you know, and like minimizing people coming in with higher bottoms, you know. And I sat back and was like, this doesn't feel helpful, you know, after when you start to look at real inclusivity and like, you know, the dilemma of being human in a racial capitalist culture, Western dominant culture, that generally that's where I'm engaging in. You're like, we're all suffering. We are all suffering. And how can we help everyone. And that led me to harm reduction, which I'm so grateful. I really think there's such beauty and power in harm reduction and this helping people figure out their story and meeting them where they're at.
I just had another thought about, you know, what, like the stratification that's even happened in the neurodivergent community, where, you know, people have been taught, we've been taught to identify as high mm-hmm. functioning or low functioning, mm-hmm. right? And who's really autistic and who, you know, and all of this other sort of separation that happens between the different types, the different neurotypes. Yes. And, you know, and that's all because of this stigma and negative associations that we're all trying to work through. But also the fact that so many, and you and I talked about this a little bit already, that so many neurodivergent people, I think, when reaching for certain behaviors or substances or activities, whatever it is, that as a stim, as a like a stimming mm-hmm. exercise or a stimming process, and how stigmatized that yes. is even stimming, and yet how normal, how everybody is doing some kind of stimulating behavior in order to rest their nervous system, in order mm-hmm. to ground. And we don't frame it that way. It's labeled stimming, and it's this special thing that's over here, and it constitutes repetitive behaviors. But somebody the other day in our circles said, what if we reframed it not as repetitive behaviors, but as rhythmic
behaviors? I love that.
And I just, then I thought about your mm-hmm. dance and, you know, your dance background and just your personal understanding of, yeah, finding rhythm in our bodies, you know,
I love that. Yeah.
What that does.
Yeah. Mean. Because yeah. it's interesting. I bit my nails until I was 12. And then I went to India with a friend and her family for 2 months. But I remember being told right before we left, you can't bite your nails in India or you'll die. So I started picking my cuticles and till they bleed. And they were just mm-hmm. like swollen and red for the past 38 years, really. And I've had so much shame about that. Mm-hmm. But that was a stimming, right? That was a way that I was repetitively. And I have, you know, have gotten very curious about that from a neurophysiobiological sense of like, am I keeping myself from going higher in a stress state? Am I settling myself? Like, what's actually happening? And it varies, but I would say it's so interesting you say that because one, I also think masking is a really interesting one where I believe there's ways that self-harm, but it's mm-hmm. masked as something else. So like my compulsion to get tattoos for a certain part of my life, I think was a masked way of cutting. And also to say that, mm-hmm. yeah, this rhythm. So like our bodies crave rhythmicity, movement, and we actually, I think, crave it in unison with others. So not just alone, but with others. Mm-hmm. And since I've gone back to dance and I've been doing some of this queer line dancing community stuff, I have finally felt like I have the agency to stop picking my cuticles. And for the first time in 38 years, I have normal looking cuticles. And I just sent my ex-husband a picture of him because I'm like, look, like I have, and I normal, but like they don't look bloody and embarrassed. And I'm wondering the connection you just made that connection to me, because I think because I'm so often now many times a week engaging in movement in unison with others, that rhythmicity to music and in agreed upon choreography, it's doing something that's really, really that I think my body really needed, my mind really needed. It's really mental health for me more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Maybe you could share why some of the common narratives around, well, you've already been talking about that, around addiction and self-harm are not just misleading, but they're harmful. And then how does your approach to ethical storytelling come in to help redefine these narratives? I know you've worked with incarcerated people. I'm just curious.
I was actually thinking about that a lot this morning because, you know, I'm really fascinated by mythology. And I recently ordered a book of the mythological symbolism of the 12 steps. And I'm really excited to dive into that. But yeah, I think in terms of ethical storytelling, what I found was for a long time, I was a part of an organization where we did storytelling circles in prisons, probation camps, in social justice organizations, and in the school system. And what was remarkable to me, or confusing as well, was that in those spaces, offering what I thought would be relatively benign storytelling prompts, and it was more personal narrative than storytelling, right? Or myth sharing. It was like, tell a story of a time when you felt like someone had your back, or tell a story about your name. You know, you could even offer something like that. But depending on the group, the demographic of the group, some people would thrive with that and feel connected and feel like, you know, rejuvenated and like vulnerable in a health, in a supportive way, a non-threatening way. And other people would fall out hard. And so this started in 2013 when I was actually working with a group of highly emotionally challenged youth. And I started to see, like, I need to understand trauma. Like, I really need to understand trauma. And this led me on my sort of trauma journey that started in 2013, which that journey led me to NCHEM and DEFO and the work at Lumos, which was the first time I'd ever encountered this concept of trauma and the idea that we are at different stages with our trauma healing. And some people need more stabilization and resourcing before they talk about what happened. And so then I really understood, oh, people are showing up in these groups, in prisons especially, right? We're dealing with high trauma populations. And it started to feel unethical and irresponsible to not lay a foundation or a groundwork of that self-agency and skill set around self-responsiveness in terms of, is it okay for me to share this story? Am I going to get flooded by this story? Is this story going to re-traumatize me? And I started to see that everywhere. There was another organization too that I'd been working with that was working with, you know, youth coming out of either probation camps or just sort of in the community and maybe affiliated with gangs or whatnot. But this group would take them into the mountains. And this now horrifies me, but they would take them into the mountains and they'd spend a weekend with them and they'd do these like super intense, you know, burying them and like putting them in cold water and then these circles of sharing. And they would talk about on social media, kids were breaking down, kids were sobbing, talking about trauma. And I won't say what the trauma is because it was horrible. It was like, and then they're like, we did it. Like they cried. This gang member cried about his childhood abuse. We won. And I started to be like, but what about after? Are they okay now? Because something people are talking about is vulnerability hangover, right? And that is another way of saying somebody's re-traumatized by telling their story too soon. So I started to see that in recovery too, a lot there. Like we said, that suffering Olympics, that come in and share your story, you know, what you were like, what happened and what you're like now, without a framework of trauma awareness and agency to even discern if I'm ready to share some stories. You see some dissociated sharing a lot. And a lot of like people getting activated their own trauma from hearing the stories or secondhand trauma, right? Like they're, and you just see, it's pretty messy. It's actually pretty messy. And not held in a way that feels relatively safe to me or supportive. So that was really the idea that if I go back and do storytelling, which I'm actually planning a kind of like line dancing program for youth, that's actually going to be more about community building and belonging for youth and reentry in the probation camps. I'm really thinking about how to offer before any, like even any sharing, you know, the framework of the toolkit, because that is such an accessible way to ground people in what is relatively safe for me or not, and what is okay for me or not. And if I go too far, can I bring myself back?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that. Yeah. Building that self dialogue so that people know where their own boundaries are, and they're not relying on somebody outside of them who's very invested in being able to produce something at the end that makes them feel like they've done their job or that the program is a success, mm-hmm. right? So yeah, these people end up getting kind of used, or not kind of used, but used, yeah, as performance mm-hmm. pieces, really, for
yeah.
that.
Yeah, you see that a lot too, not to, to veer too off track, but in, mm-hmm. in the nonprofit sector, you know, like, especially working with youth, like having the for youth sure. tell their really traumatic story so they can get more funding, you know, this is a big issue. I have a friend, Michael Cass, mm-hmm. He has an organization called Story and Spirit, and he does this work a lot with organizations, helping them stop that narrative, basically exploiting, you know, youth and stories, trauma stories.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yes, I've heard about that a lot as well. So why is a trauma-informed approach crucial for genuine healing from patterns of self-harm? So, and I guess I just want to back up for a second too. Like, when we're talking about self-harm, typically people think about cutting, mm-hmm. right? But so I think of addiction as a self-harm pattern absolutely. As well. So
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there are so many creative ways to harm ourselves. Yeah.
Indeed. Well, like you said, there becomes like this biological imperative to settle our nervous systems by any means necessary, right? And so we will do that with whatever we have available to us, yeah? And what's going to keep us as safe mm-hmm. as possible, mm-hmm. so.
I really love, I read Dissociation Made Simple by Jamie Merrick, who also has Trauma in the 12 Steps, a great approach to applying some nuance and trauma to the 12 steps. Their work is pretty substantial, but in reading there, they have a theory that all substance misuse or this kind of behavior stuff is all a dissociation. It's again, it's like that epidural, right? I'm here, but I don't want to be here. So how can I be here and not be here? How can I disappear? And so you might have ways to disappear in the moment, like alcohol will do that, right? People are not present when they drink or when you use things, or sometimes, you know, relational stuff can be that, but we'll seek, I think also in that dissociation, sometimes I think there's also, depending on what your stress state is. So if you're in more of an activated hypervigilance, I've noticed people tend to gravitate, not everyone, but for things that will make them feel more relaxed, like their dissociation is more of a checkout. And then there's people that are in so dissociated above even that sense of like they're so numb. This is where you see some interesting self-harm behaviors, right? When the numbness, people just want to feel alive. They just want to feel something. And that's where you see peak healing experiences really exploited. And adrenaline things and cutting lives here, I believe. Compulsive tattoos. I definitely have had times in my life where I would go to my tattoo artist and be like, I don't care what you do. I just want to feel the gun. I don't care if you re-pierce my nipples. Like, I just want to feel something, right? I don't really care if the jewelry's even in. And I do regret those tattoos, but a few of them. But they're also reminders, I think, good reminders of that. And we talked about, you know, the thing I was thinking about too is the scalding baths, right? Like really, I was thinking about that because I turn my bath on so hot and I get in and like hurt people, but I'm like, yeah, like I'm feeling it. And, you know, maybe that's part of this obsession with cold baths. I don't know. I don't want to speak for anyone else, but it really is something people have to decide for themselves. I can't determine what is a self-harm for anyone else, But man, I see some really interesting behavior that I think is like either a more passive or more active trying to like either feel something or not feel something.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'll just say, like, once again, we are not saying that getting tattoos equates to self-harm or taking a scalding hot bath equates to self-harm, because then that's the way we're trained, is to focus again on the external thing itself rather than the relationship to the thing. So,
yeah, I mean, yes. I just...
Just had to throw that.
But yeah, because I have tons of tattoos, right? I'm covered. I don't have much real estate left. And I just recently got a huge snake on my left thigh all the way down to my calf. And that was a choice, you know? And I remember and getting it, I really thinking about our conversations was like, this doesn't feel like self-harm. This feels like me actually a very profound, almost ceremonial. And this is my intention with it, right? So it's like the intention or the like what I'm trying to do. I wanted to actually dive into the pain, and from this creative, beautiful experience I was having, I chose to dive into the pain, not distract from it when it was happening, and build capacity around discomfort. So that's very different than when I was in my 20s and like swag, I don't care what you do, you know? This was like a ceremony and a ritual, and I'm so grateful I did it. And then there's times too, like I love a hot bath. That's just who I am, and it's soothing to me, you know? So it is like, but looking back on that, I was like, oh, are there times when I'm using it because I'm numb or like, you know? So it really is something I think people determine for themselves, you know? And maybe that's the difference too with people. And, you know, I don't know. I have so many different thoughts and feelings about alcohol as a public social drug, and how some people seem to use it with what is called impunity and some aren't, in terms of self-harm. You know, how much self-harm are people kind of unconsciously trying to do when they have the experience of they can't stop drinking, as opposed to someone who's like, ooh, I had one too many, you know, I had one glass and I'm tired and I'm going to go to bed.
Yeah. I'll never forget the stand up that Robin Williams bit he did about fuck it all. You know, that like whenever taking like he there was a pill called fuck it all that he anyway. I think it's that.
No, I was just going to say that's an interesting thing. There's actually something called abstinence violation effect, which if you, and this was what I learned about harm reduction, I thought was really interesting, is that if you have a really rigid abstinence based program, one of the potential risks of that is the fuck it's, right? Or it's called abstinence violation effect, that if you break that abstinence without the awareness of behavior change model, all the things that more inclusive harm reduction approaches include, people go like, fuck it, I'm just going to like go all out. I'm going to go all out. You know, you see that with like Atkins diet or these protein diets too. Like people have a little bit of carbs and then suddenly they're eating every muffin in sight. Like it's, so it's an interesting thing to also think about in terms of our like brain, like when we have that rigid abstinence, what happens? And that doesn't, I'm not like proposing we shouldn't be abstinent, because some things you have, like I'm so grateful I don't drink. I don't want to drink. I don't want to drink moderately. I could care less. But I work with people with disordered eating now a lot, and people have to eat. Like you can't be abstinent from food, from relationships, right? So it's a different, is that a different beast, you know?
Well, and maybe so I have a question now for like, what do you say to people who are in the midst of trying to make these changes, right? They have a sense that, you know, the way that I do XYZ or use XYZ is hurting me. And yet I don't have anything else yet.
Yes.
been my best friend through all of the tough times. It's been there for me. And even if it kicks me in the ass, it's still been there for me. And I'm still going to go to it until there's something else to replace it. I mean, I think that's partly what happens with meetings mm-hmm. and stuff like that, is that we need that replacement, mm-hmm. but it takes a while to build that replacement. And then we're in this in-between place
yes.
of like getting more awareness, trying to stop the behavior, trying to reach also for something new. Like, what do you tell people about that particular transition?
Yeah, I talk about that a lot. Replace, don't remove. I say a lot, which I wish was more prevalent in sort of the community, that an awareness of that connection to like certain recovery communities can be the replacement. And helping that be more explicit, I think, would be more helpful, because what you have is, again, that epidural, right? People are using whatever they're using to soothe or numb or feel alive. And so you take that away and they're left with like all of that discomfort, all of that suffering, and nothing to get rid of it. And their brain now has a pathway that says, when we feel this, this gets rid of it. So the brain is not the most reliable problem solver in this sense. It's like, it's got a groove that says, yes, when I feel this, whiskey does it. Right. So getting people, first of all, to realize mm-hmm. you're going to feel worse without your medicine. And so that like trying to create a new mental groove to something that's not going to kill you. Right. Something that is positive. And that's where you see, too, this kind of interesting in recovery community. You see, not only do people sort of whack-a-mole, they talk about, right, and why there's like DA and Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous and CODA and you know, all these different 12-step programs, because people will be like, I stopped drinking, but I'm gambling now compulsively, or I stopped drinking, now relationship or mm-hmm. spending or whatever it is. But people also would do that with positive things. You mm-hmm. see in the ultra running community, a lot of people in recovery, because they found something that gives them that high. And yes, it can be a better replacement, but those things can also really harm. So it's like, how do you teach people to actually, I think the key is, first of all, like this kind of comes down to what I say when I work with folks, is like the two-prong approach of the toolkit, which is that one, first I learned to assess my stress state. So know when I'm in what stress state, and then that responsiveness, is it helping mm-hmm. me? And then learn how to meet each moment with the least amount of stress possible without bypassing very natural and normalizing reactions, right? So saying that's a normal reaction to have, but you're at an 11 when you could be at a 5. And like, how do we do that? The second phase of this is kind of what I was doing with the tattoo intentionally, building capacity for discomfort. Because if you build capacity for discomfort to sit with some of those sensations and not immediately have to go to a track, even if it's a better track, right? Like, it's like being able to know how much is enough of anything, and how much do I really need? Is how much does my body need, you mm. know? And so that's where like the second part takes practice and skill daily. And that's not really addressed in meetings or in spaces, right? In recovery, it's not addressed at all. It's like, just go to meetings, do the steps. And the steps can be radically destabilizing for folks if they're not ready to do that kind of really deep repatterning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Adrian Marie Brown talks a lot about that, about her journey with finding that enoughness in any given moment, you know, and how like it has that process has to stay alive in us, you know, so that when we're engaging with the thing, whatever it is, to soothe mm-hmm. ourselves, you know, can we stay connected to that little tiny voice that's like, oh, this feels good. This feels like enough,
yeah.
you know? And it's not pushing, like saying, well, if that feels good, then let's do more, you know? It's not pushing ourselves beyond that. And that self-dialogue you're talking about invokes that conversation. It teaches us to have that conversation, mm-hmm. right? Of how's this feel? Is this okay right now? Do I need to do more? Do I need to do less?
Yeah, and that's a skill that
it takes
time to rebuild, I call it that bridge of trust to your knowing, and even being able to hear that's it's a subtle voice that says, that's enough. Like, that's enough. You know, often we are taught to bypass that, like override it. And I'll say some of the hardest, not most challenging clients I ever have or people I work with are dancers, yoga teachers, meditation teachers, you know, anybody who has been trained, even in a supportive, I'll use the word healthy here, way, right? That a non-stigmatized way, are still practicing actually dissociating, not listening to their bodies and overriding a body's subtle cue of, you know, subtle fatigue. Like I work with dancers and they're like, what is, they can't even fathom that, you know, slight.
Mm-hmm. Right. You go until you drop or you literally cannot do whatever
something
it is.
Breaks, yes. You know, I mean the ultra community, ultra community. I was in that community for a little bit. Whoa. Like, and I think there's a sense of objectification that happens maybe culturally, but I know in my family as a woman and the only girl outside of my mom, there was a lot of objectification of me and of my mom, you know? Mm. And so how I saw that play out really interestingly and maybe contributed to finding alcohol or finding these substances and using them to such a degree was there was a sense that my body wasn't my own and that it would just belong to like whatever. And it didn't have needs. It didn't have wants or needs. And so in sobriety, in recovery, I started doing marathons. And I remember being like mountain marathons, trail marathons, right? And people, and I wouldn't adequately train for them. And I'd be like, what's the big deal? You just don't stop moving. But your body will stop you from moving is what I learned. And I was like that was a, like, I couldn't fathom that concept that my body wasn't like a robot or something that couldn't just keep going. Yeah. So that's been like huge. Mm-hmm. And from the toolkit, I really learned, oh, my body has needs, has like, and has a voice.
Hmm. Oh, I hear that. Yeah, having been an athlete, a dancer, have always considered myself to be very embodied until I started learning the Resilience Toolkit and I started becoming embodied and I was like, holy shit. Like this is a totally different experience. Yeah. Now I'm actually feeling my body. I'm feeling what it's like to be in this body and didn't realize that I'd spent all my life trying to get out of that experience.
Yeah. I mean, that's really what recovery is about, right? It's folks who just desperately trying to get out of being in their bodies.
Part 2, creativity, play, and self-care. So you have been immersed in creative nonfiction, performing arts. You're pursuing this master's in depth psychology and creativity. So how do you see creativity, metaphor, and mythology playing a role in recovery and self-care?
I think I'll start by saying that most approaches to mental health and recovery are very top-down heavy, right? This idea that the thinking brain, they're very cognitive focused and they're very linear, like steps 1 through 12, or you start here and you get to here, which is a very like patriarchal kind of, you know, more of, I guess, like it's just a very pointed hero's journey, you know? And what I found though is that like that has its place, the cognitive piece. But as you and I both know from the toolkit, we have an embodied response to life first. Then that body-based reaction to life moves through our emotions, and then we make sense of it with our brain. And because if our thinking brain could fix everything, we'd all be fine, right? We'd all be fine. We could just say, body, you're not in danger right now. Chill out, anxiety. And we wouldn't need to take a pill or use a substance, right? We'd just be like, oh, you're okay. And body's like, my bad, you know, it'd be a different world, but it doesn't work that way. So like understanding that creativity is not necessarily a linear thing, and it's not always a get from here to there. To me, creativity is really about relation. It's like relational, and it's about connection to self and other, other being other people, but also the other, the ineffable, the numinous, the not knowing. And there can be real discomfort with that at first, if that hasn't been part of your life. But I do believe ancestrally, or in indigenous cultures, mostly not all, but like creativity was part and parcel of the way people move through the world. There was always the myth of the story, right? Like how we got here and why that rock is that rock. And so those stories connect us to place and time and our history, which is, can be really grounding for folks, knowing place, you know, that, and that's connection to earth too. We're started early on, but I think before we started recording, talking about, you know, ecological existentialism and like living through endings. And when we have no relationship to story, to myth, lineage, that there is a real disruption in the soul, which I think leads to also addictive behaviors and compulsions. But bringing creativity into spaces where it generally hasn't been, I see as revolutionary. I see as absolutely necessary, because it not only connects us to this sense of like bigger than me, but it also brings in play and joy. And I know for play, though, you need a relative sense of safety to play, but I also know by playing, it connects, it creates more safety and trust in a rapid way. Storytelling does too. So the idea is like, you know, I see, I've seen firsthand in some of the camps I was in and the prisons, like just when my favorite time of the storytelling circles I led was leading the games. Leading improvisational games. I know some people hate them, but like I always tried to offer them in an inclusive way, you know, non-threatening and not like perform, but like connecting games based on Viola Spolin's work, which is all about connection to space and other. It's not about being funny and on SNL, but I could see people who were so rigid, so stuck, kind of start to like do this thing, and we're all doing it together. And again, it's that like connection, and suddenly they're like loosening up and we're all laughing and there's a sense of joy and play. And then we get down and we do the harder stuff, and like starting to place the vibe and then returning to that and coming back. Like I see that as the contraction and the trough. And we know that like a childbirth is doable generally because there's a break. And we know from the work with the resilience, we'd say it's not how high you go with a stress response. It's, can you come back down? And like, no, your body's going to go up, but you come back down. So I see creativity and healing spaces as a profound part and parcel of bringing the body and the spirit and the heart into some really heavy cognitive spaces and allowing for that wave-like rhythmic way of healing, you know, of, I really think it's connecting. Like to me, it's connecting. Healing feels like such a kind of, I don't know, like there's a lot of weight to the word healing. I think culturally in the wellness culture, it's like you heal, I'm going to get to a place and I'm healed, or everything's healing. And that's beautiful. But also I think it's like, I get a lot of healing from connecting.
Yeah. There's so, I mean, yeah, you're talking about, well, so often, and I have been trained this way too. So I'm still correcting myself and being corrected about this idea of co-regulation. So when I think of co-regulation, I think of this, like this coming, this kind of coming together and settling down together. Right. But it really just means resonating, you know, which is like those metronomes. Now you see, you put a ton of them in a room. You've seen those experiments where eventually they'll start to sync up. So yeah, how are we syncing? And then I just think that's really, really cool to think about, that we can do that co-regulation. We can do that syncing up. Just through our bodies. We don't even, for so many of us that have trouble with, you know, relational in, you know, words and relational interaction, to know that we can do this just purely on a physical plane is like such a relief.
Exactly. Like, I love that word resonance. I'm going to run with that too a lot when talking about the dance communities that I found, and especially the queer line dancing one, because I'm fascinated about why folks go, who are drawn to this kind of work, right? This kind of play and creativity, the resonance of moving our bodies in an agreed way, like line dancing specifically, I'll say, there's such an accessibility generally to line dancing because you can be an oldie or a young kid and like the steps are generally, you know, accessible enough. And line dances exist in cultures all around the world. Like there are versions of it in most sort of folk dances and things where people were lining up and kind of moving together. And the resonance from that to me is such a, like people leave sometimes the queer line dancing community, stud country, and they write on their posts are like, where has this been my whole life? Well, how could I have survived without this? Like I need to be here every night. And I was working with, I'll just say too, I was working with this gentleman who's really struggling with, delightful human, but a real addiction to a relationship where the person brings meth, right? And so they engage and he keeps relapsing in the 12-step program and beating himself up. And I'm like, meth isn't your problem, right? Like the problem is this relationship. And the problem is you're so isolated. What we got to is he's so isolated. This person is providing a sense of connection to other that he desperately wants. And I was like, can you find something that brings you that resonance and that joy with other humans? I don't know what that's going to be for you, but I see it happening in these communities and the joy that fills people up so much that it's healing without being a healing activity, right? Like we don't go, it's healing line dancing. We're going to heal your trauma. It's like, we just, so this is the beauty of creativity, I think, is that we can have these incredibly deeply profound healing experiences that heal trauma, relational trauma, without talking about it, without opening old wounds, with building safety and trust in community in a way that is, you know, and that's not for everyone always, depending on the community, but that's what I see as the potential.
Yes. And I'm thinking like, so we're talking about it as a medicine, and I'm thinking about what's been happening in Palestine and the images that you may have seen of people dancing and the misinterpretations that happen around what that dancing means, and not seeing dance as a revolutionary act, you know, not seeing dance as this medicine to connect when words can't be found or when things are too overwhelming, and that we can connect through our bodies and how incredibly, again, don't want to use that word healing, but just like medicine.
Medicine and resonance. And something you reminded me of too, is I feel like lately, at least since I've rediscovered my own creative spirit and felt how that has rejuvenated my life and helped me create resonance in when I'm generally like an Olympic isolator, right? Like I'm an Olympic isolator. And that's really the crux of like my suffering is like, I can isolate like, you know, and get a gold medal for that shit. But like what I found is, and okay. So it is really hard for me to go out. And so I'm finding that, how do I want to say this? That, that I have always had this innovative spirit where I feel like I want to bring disparate things together. And I'm always like, almost like a scientist, like a research scientist, like how would this impact this? So I'm so curious about in some of these more intellectual, you know, maybe politicized sort of spaces or even trauma-informed trainings that are heavy and intense. What if we brought creativity and play and movement into those spaces not foregoing that, you know, like bringing those, weaving these things together into recovery spaces, into that. What if there was a culture that brought these two things together? Because I come up against a lot with leadership in some spaces. Oh, that's a separate thing. We're going to do the training and then we'll come and then we'll, maybe they'll want storytelling and they'll want creativity and play after. And I'm like, what would happen if we brought them together? Like, that's something I'm really curious about. And that lights me up a lot.
Yeah, I love that. You're all like almost a like a culture hacker or something, right?
Of
remaking, you're remaking these things.
And I think I've always loved, especially in the storytelling circle culture I was in, bringing experiences to people that would normally never have that experience, right? Like, so I didn't want to lead improvisational games and do that with people that were like, that's their jam. That's boring to me, you know, like a bunch of people sort of, but like bringing it to a group of men experiencing incarceration and seeing how they interacted with these games and these experiences and seeing their change was like, that's where I said I found God, you know. I don't, or like that, the, you know, the ineffable or the numen, whatever, psyche or whatever you call it, like that collective, like seeing the change in them from that stuff, not necessarily from anything intellectual or trauma healing or trauma related. It was like seeing that change was really fascinating to me with people that would never be like, I want to do improvisational games, you know?
What keeps coming to mind as we're talking is Dr. Benjamin Alexander's work and Rat Park. And I think you and I have talked about this. Is this sounding familiar? Yeah. So the experiments, I won't go into it here, but basically it's this idea that, yes, if you do that partitioning, if you compartmentalize and isolate a being, a living being from their Rat Park, that they will automatically turn to these kind of fast, easy ways of and externalized ways of settling and under any means necessary. But if you give that same rat that's been addicted, if you let them loose in Rat Park, and you actually fulfill their rat needs, that even the ones that became addicted stop being addicted. So like, but you, like, why haven't we made that connection in this culture? It's like, so these things we're talking about, like joy, creativity, dance, you know, whatever kind of fits into those categories for people. And connection with others and those types of things. That's if we can provide ourselves with our own Rat Park. And this kind of leads into the next question about building like our own self-care regimen, like actually thinking of it in those terms instead of it being this extra thing that we'll do at the end if we feel like it, you know, that's typically how I've approached it. So if we don't compartmentalize it, we integrate ourselves into our Rat Park, like what kinds of things can we install? What kinds of things can we
do? I mean, I have visceral experience of that recently with connecting to these very inclusive, all levels, all abilities, dance spaces and the queer line dancing and that. I found my Rat Park. You know what I mean? Like I found my Rat Parks. It's taken a while and Rat Parks are going to look different for everyone, but it is, you know, Dr. Gabor Maté talks a lot about addiction being, and it's a bit reductive, but a lack of connection to self and other. And I see this so much in folks, you know, especially like I have an older brother who I love dearly and he's been in and out of rehabs our whole life. And he doesn't have a community he belongs to right now. And he's not using, he's sober again, but he is suicidal. He is, you know, all these things. And he tried ketamine. I know how that works, and like, didn't work for him. Like, he has treatment resistant depression. And I'm telling him, I'm like, you need to find a place to belong, because we all need that belonging. We all need that rat park. Mm-hmm. And something that's really exciting to me, and I was telling this to the guy I was working with recently too, like, find your rat park, find your place to find joy and connection. But I think this whole movement towards like sober bars, you know, this movement towards, there's a lot of bars, non-alcohol bars that are opening up around the country. And I think in England too, maybe, but don't quote me on that. But something that's really interesting is, from the pandemic, there has been a decrease in alcohol use in the younger generations. There's been like a real like lack of interest in that. And I think that has brought to a place where I think that, you know, because people want to be social. We're social animals. We want to connect. And this is one of the biggest things about, recovery groups, is you have to kind of find a group to connect to, because that can be the connecting link. That can be your rat park, right? But also now they're finding people who don't identify as alcoholics or have gone that far and need and feel like they need that, can also find a rat park in an alcohol-free bar. Or like, how do we, you know, this idea of like more explicit ways to find connection in spaces where it's generally been about, like, because if you think about it, drinking in a bar is really a bunch of people dissociating around each other, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think modeling authentic connection to our children, like being present, like that's hard work. Mm. It's not something you or I were shown or taught.
Yes.
It's something I know we're doing our best with our children, and they'll do better with, hopefully. But I think it really comes down to this ability to be present, and to be present with pain, to be present with discomfort, to be present with the full spectrum of human feelings, because joy can also be something that, if somebody has a real deep trauma, joy can feel terrifying. So like, I go back. Yeah. Indeed. Like understanding the nervous system, understanding sensations in the body, and learning to recognize when they're helpful, when they're not, and what can you do? How can you respond to that in real time? I feel like that's how we organically and authentically create our own rat parks, because they're going to be different.
I love that. Yeah. And this is, you know, so different than what is typically talked about in the health and wellness industry on different, you know, health and wellness platforms. There's very much a prescriptive sort of orientation towards self-care. You're supposed to do, you know, 10 steps that includes, you know, a spa day or whatever. And so many of those things that are talked about are often so reflective of the socioeconomic class that person is coming from, and is not applicable, but it triggers in us, in the receiver, like, oh, that's another thing I can't do. Or that's it's very defeating. And so, how can we empower people to kind of look for certain elements, right? Elements that are in their spheres of things that will, but what you're talking about is starting first with that internal dialogue and not getting caught up in that external thing. So that we can really tell, like, is this thing part of my rat park or is it not? You know,
I think too. Yeah. I think it all goes back to really sort of the divine inspiration behind the resilience toolkit, which is such an accessible way to first learn, like, what I feel like are the baby steps to this, right? Like the first steps to figuring this out has to be grounded in this approach, this framework of self-agency and see and responsiveness and awareness, you know, And you can't be numb doing that. Like, it takes mm-hmm. some real concerted effort, right? It's hard to do when you're not mm-hmm. present. So that's the beginning one. And then what I found too is really helping people understand, like, from there, when any park they engage in or creative act, creative practice or healing modality, is this helping me or harming me? Like, you really, then the next step is being able to discern or discern in real time, like, oh, breath work doesn't work for me because I get more dissociated, or meditation isn't right. I have to move my body before I meditate, right? Like, so learning different things. Kundalini doesn't work for me. I feel nuts afterwards, right? So like, whatever it is. And then I think the third piece that comes to mind is, I just had it in my brain, perimenopause, is, I was thinking about how really interesting from Sarah Warren's work, again, it really, she talks about the pendiculation practice of the clinical somatics that she teaches as a massage from the inside out. So how you're actually, you know, she's like, in the book, you know, you, and the science is all there. You can, she goes deep. I won't do that to you now, but like, how external massages, right, or external things that we like, we get it done and it feels really good, but it's not changing the set point of our muscle fibers. So sort of like the therapeutic trauma that we teach at Lumos and with the Resilience Toolkit, people are out there right now saying, shake it out, shake it out, shake it out. And that's great. Like, I'm all for it, but that's not going to actually reset and have a lasting impact as much as creating a tremor from the inside out, right? So if I have a tremor that comes from a vibration inside out, that's going to be more effective than me just shaking my arms. Although this is going to feel good. Kind of like when I learn how to pendiculate certain muscle groups and then release them, I'm actually changing my posture. I'm changing things so I don't have that chronic repeating pain. So I take that as sort of a metaphor. Mm-hmm. Right. You can take that as a metaphor moving through, like, how do we find spaces that don't replicate pain and trauma and exclusion and, you know, systems of oppression and violence, and like really building sort of from the inside out those spaces. And some of the spaces that are very well-intentioned and well-meaning just don't have that awareness because they were created by people, right, who were probably dissociated or not really, or traumatized themselves. So I don't blame them. I just think we need to like, look at this. Like, I think it's like inside.
And Western. Yeah. And Western trained. Western and Western thinking is never about inside out. There's nothing of worth inside. It's all outside. And we need to bring it in to experience the worth. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How do you learn to trust yourself in that sense?
Yeah.
I guess I would just end with saying, I do think play is so under-resourced, underutilized, and play to me is the heart of all this resonance and line. You know, it's play. It's a sense of play. It's a sense of, and play is such a broad term, but like figuring out how do we learn to play again? As adults too, and play in spaces that we generally don't think play belongs. But like play is, I really think, paramount to being able to create these kind of spaces where people are able to heal without having to rip the band-aids off and, you know, and it can be more accessible, I hope, because the other thing, like you said, a lot of these things are inaccessible or culturally or whatever, you know, but play is in all of us. Animals play. We played as children. We should play as adults too.
Oh, and I will just say, like, I 100%, I completely agree with you about that. My experiences with drama therapy and dance therapy and working with children, and I mean, all kinds of ways that I've explored this idea of play, you know, in the last, you know, couple of decades. But before that, play was probably the most terrifying thing I could possibly think of. I mean, for when you were talking about complex PTSD, which is just shocking that it's not in the DSM yet, but for people navigating with CPTSD, play and the idea of joy feeling dangerous, like play can feel really dangerous. If you don't keep your eye on the store, basically, something terrible is going to happen. And so, so then I guess I'm just saying that for all the feelers out there who might be feeling like scoffing at the play idea, how do we stick, how do we put our toe in to play? Like, what's the tiniest little thing we can do to start playing with this idea of play?
I mean, like I said before, there it takes a relative sense of safety to play, and yet play will exponentially create more safety in that. So I think it takes skill and an awareness of who you're working with as someone providing a playful experience. But I would say generally people can access a sense of play with animals first. But you know, that there is a real sense, and like really highlighting, what does that feel like? What is it when you, you know, and that's a, sometimes not always, but an access road, right? So I think about inroads and access roads and how, because there's this idea of play as being like, play, you know, we're going to play. And yet play can be really subtle. Play can be in how you facilitate playfully. You can facilitate playfully. You can invite a playful sense into your staff meetings. You can then, like, there's different ways to add very small little creative exercises that are maybe never shared, right? So there's ways to really kind of stair step into a sharing of play. But like, there are many ways to make it very gentle, very accessible, in small little bits, but it has to start small and build. You can't just like come in and be like, okay, now we're gonna, you know, do the Herald from Upright Citizens Brigade, you know, like that would terrify me. That would terrify anyone. But like, yeah, it's like you think starting with even getting people to realize what are the playful moments in your life? If you have any, you know, where do you find those? Mm. And so recontextualizing what play is, like redefining it, because people might have very different experiences with play. When was it traumatic for you? When has it felt good? What does it even mean to you? You know, because there is this idea of what is play? Mm-hmm. I think of it more, I guess what I'm getting at as I'm spitballing here is like, it's a sensibility. It's a, you know, I've been told I'm a very playful facilitator, and that's part of how I play, right? And bring playfulness into spaces. And that is just part of who I am.
Well, playfulness implies a certain kind of spaciousness, right? That there's room to do something different. Or to do something unexpected. Or be really authentic.
As we draw today's conversation to a close, let's hold in our hearts the shared revelation that venturing into self-discovery and self-care transcends mere personal growth. It's a bridge to deeper union with both our inner selves and the collective heart of our communities. Immense gratitude to Erwin Ambrose for illuminating this path with profound depth and empathy, and for challenging the Western narrative that often paints these endeavors as highly individual and cognitive pursuits. Our journey towards understanding and nurturing our needs, especially our yearning for belonging, disrupts the cycle where shame breeds isolation, and isolation in turn deepens shame. by empowering ourselves to find what truly works for us, connecting deeply with our own voices and bodies, we redefine self-care and recovery as embodied and even playful acts. This shift enriches not just our own lives, but the entire ecosystem of our communities. For deeper insights and to access the resources we've discussed, including how to connect with Erwin and explore her impactful work, make sure to check out the show notes. As we part ways for now, hold on to the truth that every move towards deeper self-understanding and nurturing our needs not only empowers us, but lights the way for others too. I invite you to share your journey, lend your voice, and join us as we traverse the expansive realms of personal and communal transformation. Follow me on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube to keep the dialogue going. Until next time, rock on in love, dear friends. This is Mix Punk Rogers, reminding you that our vulnerabilities are not weaknesses, but sources of immense strength and the gateway to boundless empathy and connection. Let's commit to weaving a community that honors our shared truths and deepens our collective empathy, one conversation at a time.